All right. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Dr. Peter Frantsev, president of the Albert Camus Society. And today I have the pleasure of sitting down and interviewing Dr. Eric Berg, the book reviews editor for the Journal of Camus Studies and former professor at McMurray College in Illinois. And for those of you who are subscribers to the Albert Camus Radio, you know that Dr. Berg has been handling for the better part of the last 6 months of the pandemic, 20 questions on Camus with regards to interviewing Camus scholars. So now the tables have turned and it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Eric Berg and ask him his 20 questions. Welcome, Dr. Berg.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Frantsev. It might turn to Peter for the rest of the interview, but that's fine. Eric's fine after this. Yeah, thanks for turning the tables and sending the questions back my way and making me think about them.
Awesome. So let's jump into the first question. When and how did you first encounter Camus' work?
Existentialism course at Morehead State University, which has now been renamed Minnesota State University Morehead. It's a modest-sized public institution on the sister city with Fargo. Enrolled about 4,500 students when I was there. And they had a really solid philosophy department. And of course, it's gone the way that things have gone in 2019, 2020. That's one of the programs that's been cut to one philosopher now. And there were four full-time and always a VAP when I was there. And one of the full-times was a professor, Dr. David Myers, who taught existentialism. And I took the existentialism course and we read The Stranger in there and a few other of the short stories. So my first exposure to Camus was through the academic channel of a well-taught existentialism course in 1994 is when I would have taken that course and read that. And I remember reading The Stranger because I'd done some more traditional stuff in philosophy first, ethics. And I think I had an analytic course before that. And then here comes the existentialism course for reading Dostoevsky and, you know, Sartre and Camus and Kierkegaard. And really was a refreshing change for me. I also had the distinct pleasure of purchasing a Camus book hot off the press. Because in 95, the English edition of The First Man came out. Right. So I remember buying that book at a bookstore. I remember reading it in the lounge at Morehead State, you know, and getting a first pass through Camus, which you just aren't going to be able to do anymore. You get some spotty letters and some other things that have been translated or even released in French after the fact, but to be able to sit down and read The First Man when it was new in English was pretty cool. And then my entire master's thesis is based upon Jim Wolfel's book, Camus, A Theological Perspective, 1975 book by Jim Wolfel. So I really stepped into Camus as a typical undergraduate in 94, and that was it for the run until now in 2021.
Well, I'd still say you're going strong. I mean,
I hope so. I'm going to tell you what my conference paper proposal is tonight in this interview, and it's probably a little shocking for me. So that's coming up in one of the questions here. I'm gonna spill the beans on my topic, and something new.
All right. So, question number two: what are your favorite lines from Camus, and why?
Yeah, I took some time to take a look at them, and one of them is not necessarily a line. So there's always the favorites. There's the Invincible Summer inside of me and right, the opening lines, of course, from The Stranger and et cetera. But there's a particular passage in The Plague, and it's more a phrase that he uses. And this is the bus translation that I'm looking at here of The Plague, one of the newer English translations. And Camus uses this wonderful phrase here called, he coins it, mass-produced melancholy. I love that in here because it so situates the leveling effect that Camus is fighting very hard to give the reader in the plague. And this is being taped then in February of 21. We're still in the midst of the coronavirus. And that's what we're seeing is this mass produced melancholy that people that's settling on people and leveling out the playing field for the most part that way. So that phrase in particular always or has jumped out at me recently because I try to read the plague every year and I read it in, you know, one of the different translations or mess around with the French. And that I hadn't read The Bus yet. And it was very good. Another one that I particularly like is an often quoted Camus piece from the Notebooks, May of 1935. And so Camus' journal and his notebooks says, and this for me always gets right at Camus' method. Right. I cite it a lot when I'm teaching. I think it's on the second slide when I'm doing the intro to Camus piece with my students. But Camus says in the notebooks, I quote, "People can only think in images. If you want to be a philosopher, write novels." That kills it for me with Camus. It's so powerful, and I'm gonna press this in a question a little bit later, but this ability to do philosophy through the novel, I've always thought was a superior form of communication. Because to write a novel alone, as you know, which is your primary field, and have it rank in, you know, in the pantheon of great works in the 20th century or whatever have you, that's a remarkable accomplishment. Just to write something that stands the test of time and is in depth. But then to have philosophers look at it and say, well, there's arguments embedded in here. In these images that Camus has, there are arguments embedded in here. Producing philosophical arguments on their own that stand the test of time, that move the needle. That's what we're asked to do in the dissertation, right? The requirement is to move the needle in your area just incrementally, but that's what you're asked to do. And you know how hard that is. These people work very, very hard at a dissertation to move the needle just a little bit. You know, my dissertation moved the needle just beep, just a little bit in Kierkegaard studies, and it stood up to the scrutiny of the University of Kansas to do that. So to do both at once is remarkable. And there's a very, very limited set of people that can write the power and the beauty that Camus wrote with and to actually have a constructed argument embedded in there, I think is remarkable. And I think the gloves come off a little bit during these 20 questions. That's kind of in the mood. And I think if we do want to talk about the distinction between analytic and continental philosophy, which I'm not sure is actually such a sharp distinction, qualitatively continental philosophy, you have to say is better because they're able to do both. They're able to do both at once. The last quote I love, I'm sure will bring a smile to your face. It is, now Machi will probably correct me on this because the catalog is here with Machi, you know. But to my knowledge, I've read everything in English. I've read 80% of what's in French. This is the only known reference to baseball in the body of Camus' works. And of course, it comes out of the travel journals. To North America, to New York, and I quote Camus, "A host of Negro children shrieking with joy, playing stickball." So baseball played in New York. Camus observed
probably in Harlem.
Yes, in Harlem. Great image there by that. That's not a heavy philosophical quote by Camus, but it is one of my favorites.
I brought up Harlem, and I mean, you know this, but for our listeners who don't, when Camus came to the United States for his lecture tour, it was Columbia University that hosted him, and you know, geographically, Columbia is dead smack in the middle of Harlem.
Yeah.
So we're at a time. What a fascinating way. I mean, that's a brilliant quote because, you know, you and I both love baseball. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I love about that is the imagery of Camus probably walking down a street in Harlem near Columbia.
Yeah.
And watching African-American kids playing baseball. And for those baseball fans out there, you situate the time when Camus is there. This is just right after Jackie Robinson has broken the color barrier.
Yep.
And has inspired a generation of African-American boys to play baseball. I mean, that is brilliant. And then the second quote you gave, I had those exact same thoughts. I have those exact same thoughts every time I pop into the Pantheon in Paris, and you go into the vault and they've got, you know, this is where Sarkozy wanted to have Camus' body move. He wanted in 2010, wanted Camus' body, as you know, exhumed and moved to the Pantheon, and he would have been next to the likes of Rousseau and Voltaire and Victor Hugo. And the Camus family was like, nope, we're going to leave him. We're going to leave him in Provence.
Yeah.
And one of the things that is so fascinating is you go into that vault, you see the tombs of the great French novelists, and you have Voltaire next to Rousseau, and they're considered in the Western tradition, they are considered Enlightenment philosophers.
Yeah, absolutely. But
they didn't necessarily write a philosophical treatise the way that, say, Sartre did with Being and Nothingness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Camus really does follow into that kind of philosoph category, like Voltaire and Rousseau, I would argue to a degree Victor Hugo, and Henri Balzac, where you don't have to be a proper academic philosopher like Sartre or Merleau-Ponty or Gabriel Marcel.
Yep, absolutely.
And I think that is one of the most beautiful things about where Camus historically is situated, but like you mentioned, I appreciate the fact that he can play offense and defense with being a novelist and a literateur, but also a philosopher, because the philosophical arguments that are embedded into his works.
Well put, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, if Camus had not had TB and been allowed to teach at university, some of those structures may have fallen upon him and limited his creativity.
Right.
When you enter the academy formally, it changes you.
And what happened? I mean, I've thought about this. I mean, we may have talked about this over pints in the past, but what if he goes into, you know, if he doesn't have TB and he goes into academia and he tries to publish The Myth or the Rebel in an expanded version as a philosophical treatise, he would have been scrutinized. I think he would have been scrutinized even more so. And it would have been to his detriment. So, you know, I think the universe, fate, God, whatever you want to call it worked out.
You get those outsiders that change it. Wittgenstein, outsider, changes everything. Camus, outsider, changes everything. It's valuable.
All right, number three. Do you think Camus was a likable person? Why or why not?
I do, and I've done a number of these interviews, and people have answered this in a very wise fashion, including yourself. You have to situate it really carefully. I was tricky with you and Kim in that I asked about brother-in-law and friend or colleague, etc., and I toned the question down to just likable. So today, if I had a relationship with Camus like I have with you, which is friend and professional, they're intertwined, but they're both extremely valuable relationships. Yes, I think I would have liked Camus. I know him a little bit. I know this academic but has an athlete buried in there somewhere and has a rural, small kind of town background buried in there somewhere. I think he was a very engaging person. So I'd like to delve into the biography of Camus and the Simone de Beauvoir's observations of him and Sartre's observations of Camus and Barrett's observations of Camus. And clearly he was a very engaging person. You would be able to have those electric conversations that are so important to human beings. And, I used to, when I'd come back from the Camus Society meetings to McMurray, you know, I would talk to my division chair, RJ, about it. And I said, it just feels so good to get out there. And you don't have to start the conversation about Camus at the second or third peg because everybody's at nine. And you can really, really have these really deeply engaging conversations. So I think Camus, I think he was honest too. I think he was a good conversation partner. He was competitive, which I kind of like. I kind of get that. I think that he would be competitive in terms of calling you out on positions and making sure that you knew what you were talking about here and there. I think it got weird with Sartre in a number of ways, the competitiveness did, but I get that. I understand that. I think he was funny too, which is important. You know, I think he was, had the ability to be funny and to laugh, et cetera. And that's important to me too. So yes, I think he was a likable person. If you were to ask me, you know, if we go deep into the biography and talk about other people that moved around him in circles, that's a whole nother conversation. But yeah, if me in my stage of life right now, if I was connected to him in the way I'm connected to you, for instance, yeah, I'd say, yeah, he's a good guy. He's my friend.
And I think, you know, you bring up, it's hard not to bring up Sartre because they were so diametrically opposed. Yeah. You know, I mean, class structure, belief system, you know, and I think personality. I really do think that there was an arrogance with Sartre, and it probably came from his upper middle class upbringing, where, you know, things were a little bit easier for him than it was for Camus. Camus, I mean, we've talked about this. Camus was a scrapper. Yeah. And I honestly don't think that Sartre had a sense of humor. And I think that was part of the problem that he had, that Sartre had with Camus. Not to mention, I think, as you and I've discussed, and we've discussed with, you know, our colleagues, he was threatened by Camus.
Certainly.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a guy who's likable, who's funny, who is, compared to you, incredibly outgoing, and he seems to have a way with the ladies.
He does. He does. You know,
yep. I mean, Sartre was just a really, I think, jealous and in a way petty person.
Yeah. I think so. I think when Camus came into a pub or a cafe in France, you would look at him. You would remark maybe, you know, here and there. And so to get the head turns and to get to people to ask you, oh, do you know him? You know, and when he, cause I saw him sitting with you or he said hi to you, I think that would amp up that jealousy. And clearly the Beauvoir, the Sartre and the Camus triangle, they're all alphas to the extreme. So, and they're competitive and they're super smart and they know a lot of personal stuff about each other. So that is always a very interesting dynamic there. And I hope that if I would have been part of that crew, I would have been Camus' friend primarily out of the three, I guess.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. All right. I think I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but for everyone at home, do you consider Camus an African writer? Why or why not?
That's a tough one. And I see why people have kind of rolled their eyes a little bit when I asked them this question because I had to answer it too. And you know, your professor used that, throwing out these tough questions at students and looking for an engaging response. And then you write it yourself and here it comes back. You have to pay a little tax on that with interest. So I say between yes and no. Tight definition geographically, yes. Yes, Algeria is in Africa and he's born there. Done. So So he's African. He's born in Algeria, and a tight definition of that clearly makes him an African writer. But then there's the no, because he's a colonist and he's French, and his culture is French, his language is French. And when you press this issue even further, you get, you know, two levels of society. You get one form of justice for the indigenous population and one form of justice for the French, an economic system for the French or the Pierre-Noir, those that have the connections back home, and then the, you know, the economic system for the indigenous population. So it's a huge part of who he is and who he becomes, this in between, this between yes and no character from Africa. But if we just read the language the way the question is formed, in the most simple, straightforward, everyday common use of that question, he's African. But
yeah,
I do understand the distinction that you're making there, that he is a different kind of African. He is French African.
Right. I wonder if, and I can't, for the life of me, I can't remember if anyone brought this up in the previous 20 questions, but I wonder if we can, you know, suffice it to say that instead of saying he's European or he's African or Algerian, you know, instead of leveling those kind of distinctions where no one wins, you call him a French writer and the Algerians are ticked off. You call him an Algerian or an African writer and the French get ticked off.
Welcome to my classroom. Those are the kind of questions I ask.
I'm probably going to do something along 20 questions with my students this spring. But I wonder if we can just, you know, put the fire out and just call him a Mediterranean writer.
Good, because he those are the roots.
I mean, he's got one leg in France and he's got one leg in Algeria.
Yep.
You know,
Mediterranean, both sides. Plus he loves the Greeks.
So, yeah.
You know who's good in this is, this won't come to any surprise, Luke Richardson.
Yes.
Yeah. Luke was fabulous on this question. Absolutely. But that's right where the dissertation is. That's his wheelhouse. So
yeah,
I like that though. He's Mediterranean. Yep.
All right. Number five. Which character that Camus created do you identify with personally and why?
Cotterd. Absolutely. Right. And I'm going to relinquish to Simon here. Danny DeVito plays Cotterd. Especially the Danny DeVito in the meme where he says, I just started blasting. I read the description over again and again, and Danny DeVito plays Cotterd. So Cotterd is Lutheran. I don't know how it got embedded in Camus. I don't know if he picked enough of it up through Kierkegaard. I don't know if it's a combination of Augustine and Kierkegaard soaked into Camus. But if I were to read this to a couple Lutheran, if I were to read the character of Cotterd out to a couple Lutheran theologians or astute pastors that are well-versed in the confessional wing of the Lutheran church, he's so Lutheran. And not necessarily his actions or his, not that he's a, you know, criminal and that doesn't, I'm not saying that Lutherans are criminals.
Right.
It's the character, it's the conditions that Camus used in the plague to illuminate something very, very important. And each character does that in the plague. And Cotterd illuminates this really critical piece in Lutheranism about Kierkegaard's distinction between fear and anxiety. And it's so central. It's
right.
It's in Luther, but then Kierkegaard picks it up. And fear has an object. That's the point of this whole thing. Fear has an object, and you can usually do something about it, or you know what it is. So you didn't pay your taxes, so you know that the IRS is chasing you somehow digitally, and it's the bill's got to be paid or it doesn't. You have a tumor, it's malignant or it's not. You have an exam coming up, it's a B, an F, a D. You didn't study the right stuff. You studied the right stuff. That that fear of that exam is going to come, and that grade is going to come, and et cetera. So things that we fear have nouns, have objects attached to them. Anxiety does not. Anxiety is this idea that there's endless freedom out in front of you. And more importantly, that that freedom comes to an end. So it's important what you do with this time. And that's the anxiety that settles, because nothing will stop that. That end comes. So it's an important distinction between the two. And Cotard it's magnificent the way Camus actually flips Cotard from this standard narrative I laid out very cleanly, very Lutheran-like. This is fear. This is anxiety. Here's how we distinguish between the two. Of course, in a theological context, the only way to solve anxiety is through Christ, and away you go with that. But Cotard, he flips it with Cotard, which I find is fabulous, because Cotard is being crushed by the criminal justice system, right? And for the right reasons. He's done something that is either a penal colony in South America or the death penalty. He's done something very, very serious, and they're closing in on him. And then the suicide and et cetera. But then plague comes, right? And the civil authorities don't have the time to chase down people like Cotard. Number one, Cotard can't leave. And some people do leave, right? But the odds are that Cotard's not going to be able to get out of Oran. So the civil authorities have 1.5 million other things to do and don't concentrate on tracking down Cotard. So there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to Cotard. There's pre-plague, there's plague, and there's post-plague. Pre-plague, Cotard is being crushed by this end that's coming to him, and he tries to commit suicide, and he doesn't pull it off. And then there's middle Cotard, where he's the freewheeling, everybody's friend. There's 1 million pounds have been lifted off Cotard. He is free. He is experiencing this joy that he never could have imagined, because that burden has been lifted from him. And then plague comes to an end. And he even says it many times in the dialogue. Some shocking lines from Cotard. I don't want this to end, you know, because I go back to this. And what does he do when plague comes back? Gets in this ridiculous shootout with the police. And so it's absolutely reversed. You know, the narrative that we get in Lutheranism and the narrative that we get from Kierkegaard is you suffer under this burden of anxiety, and then Christ lifts it. And he just beautifully paints that in a sort of reversed, Christ reversed sort of way. And I just think it's intentional, because he's got that clear narrative in The Stranger, you know, this is the Antichrist, or this is the opposite Christ.
Right.
And I just, Cotard is it, without a doubt. I love the character of Cotard.
Okay, so quick follow-up question, and you could just answer it with a yes or a no. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be your conference paper?
No.
Someday. Oh! Cotard is
it will be. It's all cooked up, you can tell. It just kind of
flows. Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah.
Which is why I had to ask.
Yeah, you'll see. It's coming. Right. I haven't spilled a breath of this to anybody. So.
All right.
Well, no, I take that back. Wolfel knows.
All right.
Yep.
All right. Question 6. Who is your least favorite character in his body of work, and why?
Martha from The Misunderstanding.
Nice.
Now, this doesn't reflect on my student Lex. If she listens to this, she played Martha when we put on The Misunderstanding at McMurray. Martha is pure evil. She is purely centered on the self.
Yeah.
To chase this Mediterranean dream and drag all these people to their death by homicide or death by suicide, just to establish this fairy tale that she sees as living in the Mediterranean. So she's my least favorite character by far, but Camus does a wonderful job with her, right? Because Martha is teaching the lessons that Camus really wants to teach, that chasing this fairy tale, Christianity, or this other fairy tale, communism, you're Martha when you do that. You're sacrificing all of these human beings for this this fairy tale in the future. So, you know, communism, we sacrifice this generation and the next generation and the third for the fourth to be better. In Christianity, you give up this tangible life that you have here for the afterlife. Camus, very, very much opposed to that. So Martha, while my least favorite, is a nice study in getting right at Camus' work. But she creeps me out. She's bad news, Martha is.
You know what's great about that, and it, I mean, you saw, I think, by my expression on my face, is when you've asked that question of all of us, we came back with, you know, we came back with what I think were the standard bearers, you know, Meursault or Cotterd or Clements,
yeah.
You know, Clements, all three, I think, were in the running for who was the most popular with regards to the scholars. No one's come up with Martha. And so this shows, I think it shows two things. I think it shows with your answer, not just that we can think outside of the novels and look to the plays. Mm-hmm. I think, and Caligula was another one.
Yeah.
And Caligula, you know, a play. Mm-hmm. But it shows, you know, Martha is evil because she has a multitude of ulterior motives, where she is cold and she is calculating.
Yeah.
Meursault doesn't care. Cotterd, it's survival of the fittest. Clements is playing games. Mm-hmm. Caligula, you could argue that Caligula has some sort of not a brain tumor, but he has some sort of abnormality, you know, neurological abnormality, which is causing him to do this. But Martha, Nellie, man, Martha is primo. I mean, and the cool thing about Martha, not cool, I mean, lowercase c, air quotation marks, is because students and readers, and I would say even scholars, haven't really looked as deeply at the plays as they could.
Yeah. Yep.
She flies right under the radar.
Yeah, she does. She does. Yep.
So that was brilliant. That was brilliant.
Thank you. I think because we put the play on, I spent so much time working with it that she creeps me out big time.
Okay. 7. Is Camus' work dated? Is it timeless? Is it a mix? Answer and expand, please.
Yeah, it's a mix. He's not at his, well, okay, so you're going to set aside a certain amount of stuff like the Algerian Chronicles, and you're going to set aside the combat pieces for the most part because they're episodic pieces that were written for a particular reason. So I don't know how many people left on this earth would understand all the things that are going on in a combat piece, because it's like Parisian politics at the ward level almost sometimes. So you just don't know these people anymore. What the heck was this about, you know, or you know, these people. So I think, to be fair, you set aside the a lot of the journalism, set that stuff aside. The rebel is dated, I think, in my estimation. I don't want to get too close to Sartre, but there's an awful lot of name dropping in The Rebel. And I think 161, I may have read, somebody did a hand count of thinkers that are dropped in there. And it just, I don't know, it doesn't have the wherewithal. It doesn't have the legs that a number of his other pieces have. So I think there's a certain segment that you set aside because the question is obvious that they're dated. Interesting for historians of Algeria and Paris and France maybe, but I don't think the ideas are very timeless there. But then there's some middle ground where, yeah, it's dated. Some of these ideas are particularly dated, but then there's some that are timeless. I mean, look at the incredible worthwhile attention that the plague has brought with COVID. Amazon ran out at one point.
Right.
The French edition ran out at one point, like March or so. you couldn't get it through Amazon.com, which is amazing, you know, that you couldn't get a copy of that book. There's like a 2 week period where the wait was 2 weeks for it, unless you wanted a digital package, but to get a paper version of it. And it's not just the title, right? Because there are other books about plague, but it just hits so many key themes that we've gone through and we're still going through. And the immense amount of journalists that wrote paralleling the plague with our times, and, you know, the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Los Angeles Times, the Guardian, all these really, really powerful, well-respected newspapers and journalistic outlets wrote pieces paralleling to. So, and The Stranger, you know, the Stranger has captured generations of 20-year-olds. That's when it got me, you know, mid late 20s. I see it in my students when they read it. They like it. It's this gateway to higher thinking that way. So he has a remarkable ability. I would be confident that a Western civilization class 50 to 75 to 100 years from now, he might be on the great books list still. You know, it just, he's got something there.
Right. No, I agree with you. I agree with you completely. And kind of on the heels of that last comment about, you know, Camus being on a great thinker's great books list 50 to 100 years from now, let's go into question number 8, which is, Camus is most often included in the club of Western philosophy. Granting this premise, what makes one writer a philosopher and another a not? For example, Camus and, say, Hemingway.
Yeah, it's intentionality. I think it's there's craft and there's intentionality. And I don't want to use the word craft in a lower way. It kind of harkens back to one of my earlier answers where there's this astonishing ability to do both. And one should be respected fully for the craft of writing and for the ideas that are produced there. I don't know a lot about Hemingway, but I've not studied Hemingway in a philosophical framework, nor have I ever been asked to, nor have I run into a lot of literature that does. Wonderful writing. I think it's timely. I think everybody has their turn with Hemingway and they enjoy it a great deal, but there's not the systematic argumentation that is present in somebody like Camus that brings him in, existentialism or not. He belongs in that club of Western thinkers. I usually frame this question with my students using Aristotle's Poetics, I think is a good way to get after this question, with logos, eros, and pathos in Aristotle. And to do any of those as a master at it, I think is a phenomenal achievement. But to be able to introduce logos into ethos and pathos, especially ethos, the impact that the narrative makes on you is what I would describe as ethos, and logos would be the argument, what you're trying to do with this, what is the telos, what is the end goal, why are you writing this, is it for ethos impact, is it for pathos, is it to bring the emotion. I think Hemingway is a very good example of pathos done very, very well, especially for men, right? Men over 40 love Hemingway because we're there. We're fighting the fish, you know, and we get it in that sense. So there's lots of writers that do that very well, and that's an important and it can't be overlooked because very few people can do that. But to introduce logos to it is remarkable. And Aristotle, I think, understood that and saw it in Plato, probably. Plato, we don't have Aristotle's dialogues, so we don't know Aristotle's level of skill with pathos, logos, and ethos to write in that way. But I put Camus with that group of Kierkegaard, Augustine, Plato, Dostoevsky, in that Nietzsche, in that they have an intentionality, they have an idea, right, that they want to communicate, and they're going to do it. And this is where I think Camus has a very distinct advantage with his theater background.
Right.
Because I always see the plague as a play. He sets the stage and he puts these characters on it and away they go. And they we identify or we are drawn, the narrative, you know, the ethos draws us into each one of those characters, but they're teaching us something along the way. So it's intentionality. It's the intention of putting logos or the idea, the argument into your craft that way.
Right. No, that's great. And I like this idea that, you know, to think of the plague as a play, that would be a fantastic lecture session or two with a class. Yeah. Because when I teach the plague, I mean, I've never taught it that way. I just kind of have a fleeting comment when I introduce the novel that there are five parts that are really indicative of an ancient Greco-Roman play that has five acts. Yep. You know, the introduction, the three rising action acts, and then the climax and the conclusion in the final act. So
you want to end it on a funny note for your students?
Go for it.
This is honest to God's truth. You can find it on the Googles. And you probably can find, I have a clip that is on YouTube. South Korean traveling company, play company, playhouse, made a musical of the plague. It's everything you think it will be. So it is a nice way to end, to lighten up the mood and show some scenes from the South Korean musical on Camus' play.
So. I will have to definitely look that up. So
it's thank out there.
Thank you for that recommendation. All right. Number nine, Gilbert Award translation. Why? And yes, you have to pick because you made the rest of us pick. Yep. And then as far as bios are concerned, Lottman or Todd. And again, yes, you have to pick.
It's Gilbert for sentimental reasons. It was my entrance into Camus. And you don't really forget the structure of the first time you read a book like that, if it's going to grab you. And I've taught it through Gilbert so many times that I know I have, you know, sections of it memorized. I can't quite call them up in the middle of a conversation about the Dodgers and the Twins. But, you know, when I'm working with my students through The Stranger, for instance, you know, I can remember what was said here and what is to be said and what has been said in almost the same words that are there. So for sentimental reasons,
Gilbert.
It's Gilbert. And Lottman is always my go-to when I'm starting about the second or third stage of my writing on Camus. I want to get everything that happened before, during, and right after, if I'm writing about something in particular. Like when I did that piece on when Camus went to New York and was held by the FBI, you know, Lottman gave me in excruciating detail everything he did before he got on the boat, and then Camus gives us excruciating detail on the boat and in New York, and so does Lottman, and then Lottman gives us what it was like for Camus to come back to post-war France in 46 right after that trip. So I go to Lottman quite a bit to frame what I'm working on. If it's not a large concept that's sweeping over the entire text, if it's focused on something, I go to, you know, I like the Todd too, but Lottman is the go-to there.
Awesome. And number 10, halfway through. Yeah. Did Camus cultivate his physical public image, his cult of personality, or was it natural and not contrived? And after you give us that answer, why do you think that particular way?
He cultivated it. I think he cultivated. I was shocked that most people that I've been interviewing thought he didn't. I thought he had a sort of je ne sais quoi. He had a sort of inner coolness to him. And then what he put on over it helped a little bit, amplified it a little bit. He cultivated it. I mean, you go back to the biographies. He spent an awful lot of money on his clothes when he was trying to be the artist in Algeria through the uncle. You know, he spent his time there, and you see the photographs of him as a young man. He's, you know, he and Simone, they have the matching outfits and etc. I think he cultivated the image that he had very carefully. I don't think it was an obsession, but I think it was very, very clear that when he went out in public, he was making a statement. I think there's an intimidation factor there that he's not afraid to use, knowing that, you know, everything is put into its place just right with the cigarette and the collar and the clothes, etc. I think it was a carefully. I'm not afraid to move in that direction from the other people I've interviewed and saying it was a pretty carefully constructed image that he was doing about himself to. Well, you know, he had to fight too. Like you said, he's scrappy. He came from nothing. So yeah. Management of your public image is very important. You know, the other people had a lot of resources to fall back on. But I think Camus was very aware that management of his public image was very important. And it was up to him to manage that. And the way he looked and appeared made him stand out, certainly.
Well, the other argument could be that if it was contrived, that he cultivated it, he did it because he was insecure, and it was a way to control his image. It was a way to control how people saw him.
I think you're right on that. I think there's probably an element of that there, that it is a control feature, and that is something that he could control. So yeah, I think you're right on that.
All right, number 11. What is the biggest weakness in Camus' work, and why?
This is a hard question to answer because, you know, who am I to criticize Camus? But it's asked, right? And I've asked others, and graciously, everybody has answered. It's his indecision on some really important things that drive me crazy. And you can see by the way I've asked these questions of my colleagues in the world of Camus, I force them to make a choice, right? It's Gilbert or Ward. Don't break my rules. That so again, it's didactic in a way, but it's just my personality sometimes, because I'd like to see where this takes us. So the indecision is one of the things that drives me a little bit crazy about Camus. His indecision about politics in particular. I won't talk about his personal life, that he never really could decide if he was married or not. But his indecision about politics is really difficult. He had two very, very clear arguments that he could have stood on with the whole communist issue. You know, the reason that he got kicked out in 37 and the reason he was, you know, I'm fired, no, I quit. It was that sort of thing with the Communist Party, which I think it went in that order. You're kicked out, well, I quit, is because they decided not to stand up for the indigenous populations, the workers' rights. Were only for the Pierre-Noir. They were only going to be for the French colonists, is what the French-Algerian Communist Party was going to fight for. And Camus, and I don't know where why he left this and didn't press the issue of the indigenous population in his fictional works, but that's why he left We Leave You, You Leave Us early on. That's a really good reason not to be a communist, because they're racist. He had a racist experience with that. And this is 37, long before the eyes are open in the world to this particular issue, which you brought up to his trip in America in the late 40s would have helped with that. And then his theoretical problem with communism was really clear. And I talked about it in like eighth grade terms about, you know, sacrificing the future, these generations for the future, a really good reason not to go for it. Not even to mention, you know, because he got criticized, rightfully so, because I think he drew a necessary connection between Stalin and communism. And we know that, you know, theoretically, communism has gone off the rails. You know, practically, right. It's gone off the rails, but theoretically, it's another thing. So I don't think that was a great move by him, but his indecision there is. And, you know, I didn't live in 1946 in post-war France, which, you know, what are you going to do? You got the fascists and the communists and the workers' rights, etc. And then with Algeria, you get the same thing with Algeria. And I'm not even clear in my head how he should have thought about it. I'm clear in my head how he should have thought about it because I was born in 1967, right? And began my in-depth political studies in the late 80s. So colonial period, we had focus on it by 87, you know, when I'm in college, really clear, and especially because I studied as an undergraduate under a professor from Sierra Leone, you know, so an Anglophone nation, and he was very illuminating of that situation. So where I am now, I'm very clear about how I wished Camus would have been on it, but I don't know that I could have been that clear in 1950 or 51 about the issue of Algeria. So it's the indecision, and in his favor, the weight of fame sort of broke him in the 50s. He didn't want to be the voice. And well, you are, you know, I feel this way about professional athletes. There are some professional athletes that are not articulate and they just need to hit the ball and do their thing. But then there are some athletes that are articulate, that have a lot going on up here, and they need to. They need to use that social platform to advance causes of justice. Same thing, Camus. Yeah, you are articulate. I kind of get the fact that you can't, you know, you can't buy a new wristwatch without the world going crazy because you bought this brand of wristwatch and not the other. Mm-hmm. But it comes with The Stranger and The Plague and those novels that have such a deep impact. So yeah, the stage was alone. The stage was frightening. The stage was a great deal of responsibility, but you're on it and you have a voice and you're articulate. So that's my problem with Camus.
Gotcha. Okay, number 12. If a biographical movie of Camus were to be made, who plays him, dead or alive?
I do like how these questions float from, you know, these hardcore political questions to who plays Camus in a movie, which is nice because it lightens it up. John Travolta of Pulp Fiction. Case closed. Perfect.
I have no follow-up. I'm going to have to wrap my head around that for a couple of days. And then, okay.
He's a dandy. He's cool. He's quiet. He's kind of funny. He looks like there's a lot going on underneath him. It's John Travolta of Pulp Fiction. That Travolta.
All right. Okay. I like I said, no follow-up on that. All right, 13, you've written and published on Camus. Pick one of your works on Camus, and what do you think his reaction to your work would be?
So here it is. Unlucky 13 is the question where I'm going to tell you what I've been working on for the 2021 Albert Camus Society conference to be held in London or Dublin.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. This is a godsend to be able to communicate, but boy, it's nice to be face to face. So the title of the paper that I've been working on is Réau is No Hero of the Plague.
Wow.
He is not a hero. He is an absurd hero. He is not a moral hero, nor is he a medical hero. He, contrary to what everybody says, he doesn't say plague first. Castle.
You're right.
He doesn't. He has, Castle is a forcing out of him. He puts the words in his mouth, and it's the other doctor that actually says it. You have to drag Réau to this obvious conclusion. Dead rats, you know, the swelling, etc. He's drugged to this obvious conclusion there. He violates his medical promises over and over and over again in the text. He uses his medical pass to go swimming. He goes outside the city with a friend, violates the medical pass to go swimming. He does not turn in three of his friends to the infirmary when they're supposed to go. He lets them die or treats them at home. He's not good. He's not good. He's not trustworthy. He says himself, if you can trust these journals that I'm using. And Teru, in the end, begs Reu to give him the straight scoop on his diagnosis. Why would your best friend beg you to tell you the truth in a medical situation if he didn't have a history of not telling the truth? Plus, he does nothing about the escape attempt. It's like, yeah, I'm here. I know you're going to do it. I know you're going to leave. I know you're going to drag Plague to the other part of North Africa to get out. But, you know, that's fine with me. He's a problem. And he's built up as, I think I start the paper with like 18 quotes from really important sources saying Reu is the hero of the novel of Plague. He's the absurd hero because he continues to do his job.
Like Sisyphus.
Like Sisyphus, but he's a moral, he's not a moral train wreck like Martha or, you know, et cetera. But he does, in a number of occasions, he does not do the right thing morally, and he does not do the right thing according to the medical code.
Okay, so that is going to be fantastic. And I think, this is just me being selfish, I think if we are not able to meet in person in 2021, you have to save that for when we are. We won't be able to do it over Zoom. I mean, you can, but the gravitas with what you're going to level everybody, and I'm going to keep my mouth shut. Although, when this gets out,
that's true. There'll be some prep.
It's going to be, that paper will end the first or the second day of the conference, because that's going to get carried straight into the museum tavern.
Exactly. That's what I was hoping for. Yep. The carryover conversation.
Or a pub in Dublin. But man, oh man, that is.
The phrase that Wolfel used was provocateur. That's what you're being. I'm like, exactly. It's a conference. We all know Camus. We're all friends. I read it, you know, recently again. I'm like, this guy's not as straightforward as we think. And then I started documenting it as I read it. It's trouble.
And so that, well, I mean, you just answered my next question, which was going to be, what did Jim think of it? And yeah.
I think because I sprung it on him too. And I think so, you know, he's processing it too. So, that's fun.
That is going to go, I mean, my gosh, genius. All right, 14, Camus often used real people as characters in his work. He took part of their psychology, physical appearance, and life story and made an often thinly veiled character of them. How do you feel about Camus doing this? Is there a moral component to this that should be addressed?
It's typical of the style that he writes in. So, and most of this was done before he really started swinging at Sartre and de Beauvoir. So, and you know, I think by the time the fall, we have a very clear caricature, an unfriendly one of Sartre in there. But most of this happens in The Stranger and The Plague, where he draws people in, and I've always find it fascinating. Most often when a character is named by Camus, there's a pretty deep meaning behind it. And most often when you look at the character, it is often slices of his life thrown in there, but other people thrown in there too. So if it's used as an attack, you can do better. But I understood the environment that he was working in. But I think it's a natural thing that an author has to do to fill a character out in the way that Camus did. He saw this in somebody. Or, you know, if you read his journals, you see all these little anecdotes that he wrote down of people in cafes and et cetera. And they work their way into the text. So same thing, you know, he sees these people and these mannerisms and they work their way into a particular character. So if it's an attack, there's a moral issue there, and I think you could just do better than an attack. And I think it might draw something away from the text. It's probably why I think a lot of people would rank The Stranger and The Plague as the great works of Camus, and The Fall is next down on the list in terms of the novels. And maybe he got too caught up in that, you know, having to, you know, jab at Spard here and there, you know, and make it veiled attack. So maybe, yeah.
Okay. All right. 15. In 1959, Camus said he was working on another novel not connected to The First Man, but it was to be another original work. What do you think or hope that text was to be about?
What I think would have probably been an important issue for Camus to explore, because I'm not going to say Algeria, because that's where The First Man goes and is going. And we probably had a trilogy built in that First Man set, but I'm probably leaning towards the nuclear war issue or nuclear non-proliferation, but it's going to be in the way that he did it with the plague, right? So he takes, you know, a biological disease and it becomes this fabulous narrative of World War II. So I think there would have been some creative genius way to write something and make it clear to the audience, you know, the impact of nuclear weapons that were starting to set the stage and the tension between the superpowers. I think that would have been an obvious move for him and a necessary move, I think. Right. The Nobel Prize may have compelled him to write something like that too.
Yeah.
A little more responsibility. Now my hope is next novel would be about sports. Long love of football, right? And his ability to play it. And when he said he learned everything of moral value on the field there.
Yeah.
I would have loved to see him write on sports. And he was becoming to appreciate boxing towards the end of his life too. So my hope would be that maybe he would do something with sports, because that was deeply ingrained in him. But my guess would have been nuclear non-proliferation, nuclear war, something like that.
And that, I mean, if that's indeed what he was planning, mm-hmm. what a great bookend in mm-hmm. terms of novels. You've got a novel in The Plague, which essentially deals with a kind of biological warfare, at least humanity's warfare against biology. And then you could have, and then if he were to write about nuclear proliferation or nuclear holocaust between the superpowers, you know, then it becomes, you know, a man-made war, yeah. you know, where the plague wipes out, you know, what have we come up with, like 20 to 25% of the population of Iran, whereas you could easily do that, if not more, between in a novel between the superpowers, where it winds up becoming a nuclear holocaust. So yeah. I mean, that is, again, that's you know, definitely a great idea and thinking outside the box, you know, on that one. And I think you're right. I think being called to win the Nobel Prize in 57 and to have the tensions rising so quickly, you know, what's fascinating with you know, Camus and when he dies is if he wouldn't have died for another three more years, he would have seen the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, that.
Yeah. Yeah. The brinksmanship, I mean, that was there. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep. I mean, you know, and there's, you know, I've often told my students that there's a kind of, with the plague, especially now, more so than with Ebola or SARS or West Nile, there is a you know, there's a propheticness to his literature. So it's very possible that he would have written on the nuclear element, so to speak, just as things, and the book would have been published just as things come to a head. Between the superpowers.
You're right. Yep. Wouldn't have taken long. It's 3 years from fall to the next round, 1960-61, it probably would have been published.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. So that takes us to question 16. What artist would you like to see Camus collaborate with? And that can be music, static arts, film, etc. Oh, and what would you like to see, why and what would you like to see them make?
I think there's a great choice here. I think the Bogside Artists in Derry, Northern Ireland.
Nice.
Yeah, I think the colonization piece, right? It would have allowed him to maybe get a little bit more clarity on that from his own. But you know how when you visit Northern Ireland, when you see the fence and the separation fence in Belfast and the murals in Derry, and you go into, you know, pubs in Derry especially, and they have Palestinian flags there. And that's a marker for the IRA. That's, you know, that's what goes, that's the bar we're in here. This is a Irish bar. This is a, you know, a resistance bar. So I think that the collaboration would have been wonderful because Banksy does that. You know, Banksy got involved with the Palestinian issue in Israel and did some wonderful pieces on that issue. And I think following or leading that vein, I think Camus and a collaboration with Bogside Artists in Northern Ireland, I think would be a powerful, powerful piece somehow of to put the two together, because it would have struck that colonial issue with him so well. And it was so wonderful to have those scholars from Northern Ireland at the Camus Society that were making those connections with the colonial work and the colonial issue and Camus in Northern Ireland. Again, too, that's one of the things that triggered my thinking about this, is I think that would be a fabulous collaboration would be there.
Definitely, definitely, definitely. All right, 17. Who would you like to see Camus debate or box, living or dead, and you can't start? And what topic or what sets them off into the ring?
The debate, I think I want to see Camus, and I don't, you know, so we got magic wands all over the place, right, with these questions, so some of that stuff just goes out the door. So either Camus is drug into the 21st century and he has the sensibilities of a liberally educated person in the 21st century to engage in this debate, or Kamala Harris is brought back to 1950 and she has the typical educated sensibilities of a liberally educated person in the 1950s. So one of those two scenarios, and to get Camus into a discussion with a female thinker, I think would be fabulous for the engagement process that would take place there. I know that a lot of the secondary literature, de Beauvoir indicates it personally, but a lot of the secondary literature indicates that he intimidated him. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see that the dynamic that would be there and the engagement that would be there between the two. Somebody, you know, really smart and fair debating him. Boxing would be interesting because he's not the biggest guy that you'd have there, but it would have to be somebody who has a little bit of skill. I think Nietzsche might be a good boxing competitor, like those weird Hollywood boxing matches that were put on maybe 10 or 15 years ago, or right. I think Screech just passed. Yeah, I think he fought in a few of those. So Danny, the Partridge Family guy, fought in them. So yeah, Nietzsche might not be bad there. I did have another footnote to this. I would like to see this happen. Not a debate, but I would like to see like a Jeopardy style contest with you hosting it. And it is Machi and Camus. And you give a line that Camus wrote and watch Camus and whoever gets it the proper date and location wins. I bet Machi beats Camus at that.
Yeah.
Because you'd give a line and Camus would say, oh, I wrote that in a letter to, or I wrote that, that's in my journal, you know, that's in my journal. I'm actually like, no. It's in this letter in 1947 and it's in October and it's an actually, you know, you're replying to this person. And I think Machi would actually be able to situate more of Camus' work than Camus himself. I would like to see that.
No, I definitely, I mean, he definitely, Machi, being that he has the mind for that. I mean, he has the sharpness. I mean, you know, we talk about how we all bring, you know, different things to the table. You know, George is able, Heffernan is able to contextualize Camus in kind of the bigger element of the history of philosophy, whereas Machi is able just to I mean, he'd cite the page number and the paragraph and the line number.
Yep.
You know, he has the astute mind for that.
Often when I'm presenting at the Camus Society, during my talk, I will say, unless I've overlooked anything, and look right at him and know that there'll be an email, very friendly, 4 days later.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Absolutely. No. And he is, you know, like so many of our colleagues, he is definitely a gentle soul.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He is absolutely a pleasure to present with and to work with. All right. 18, home stretch. Here we go. What is one thing that Camus has taught you from reading his work?
Art teaches well, if not the best. He's, again, it's a theme by going through these questions, I can see that it is a central theme for my understanding and reading and presentation of Camus to the world through me, is that art teaches very, very well, if not the best. Yeah. It's fabulous what he can do. And it's so meaningful and so clear. And you would think that it would be up for a million different ways of interpretation, but it's really not. There's variations, there's degrees. There are places where he's vague, but not the important stuff. It's there, and art teaches well.
Awesome. Okay, so who was the bigger influence on his work? His mother or tuberculosis, and why?
Tuberculosis, 60-40. So advantage tuberculosis. Yeah. I tend to, especially the last 3 or 4 years, I tend to see a lot of his work through the plague. So I tend to maybe use that as the primary lens for seeing Camus, but the death sentence that he was put under at age 17 is really important, I think, for, like you talked about, George Heffernan, and again, the larger picture in Camus is painted that way because he gets that, and this is Wolfel's language that I'm using here, and I'm always indebted to Jim deeply on these things. He always used to talk about it as an indictment, and it's perfect, right? Because you've been indicted and it's going to come. The guilt is there and the punishment is there. So it is the tuberculosis diagnosis was an indictment, and it changed so much. He couldn't serve the military. He tried 3 times to try to serve in the military in World War II. He couldn't teach at the formal level because of the TB, lost the first wife with heroin, but the affair was triggered because of that, and he was separated from everybody because of the TB and the pain, the physical pain that he went through by deflating the lungs and reinflating the left lung with that was terrible. So it's the death sentence that was given to the young man at age 17 that is a real big influence. And mother's a huge influence too, but it's 60-40 in my book, tuberculosis.
Well, and it's always that, you know, death looms near. I say,
absolutely.
His mother is the influence in the early works, up to and including The Stranger.
Yep.
And then it's tuberculosis.
Yep. I agree. It is. Death looms near is a very, very good way to put it.
And then it kind of comes back. I mean, you know, well, not necessarily. I was going to say it comes back in the plague, or not the plague, the fall. But no, the fall, I would say it's tuberculosis with the knowledge of death. And then, of course, you know, Clemence claims to have stolen the judges panel from the Ghent altarpiece. So there's that, you know, there's that influence there, that element. So anyway, all right, last question.
Okay.
Number 20, if you could ask Camus three questions, what would you ask him? And I'm going to tweak this one a little bit and say, how do you think he would answer those questions?
Okay, great. First question I'd ask him, please clarify your view on Christianity.
Okay.
Really make some distinctions here. Really dig in and clarify it. So the letter to the, or the discussion with the monks is fantastic. The Jesuits, the priests is fantastic. It does a great job of getting us there, but I would really like to see him clarify his views on Christianity and get some clarity to this. How I think he would answer this, I think he would say the patristics got it right. The early church fathers, first generation outside of the New Testament narrative, probably got it right. I'm not saying he's a believer. I'm not saying he's coming to faith, but Christianity has a narrative. Whether Christ was a real thing or not, there's a narrative. There's a literary narrative stretching from, you know, the Gospel of Mark forward. And I think default for Camus are these Mediterranean thinkers, like we talked about earlier. The patristics, the early church fathers, are almost all Mediterranean figures, or they are Mediterranean figures. So that first generation of narrative writers about Christianity probably is where he is going to find his home. And then I think he would footnote Kierkegaard quite heavily. Just because if we step back and we take this really broad picture of philosophy, and you know, you were forced to somebody comes to you and says, here's $100,000, Dr. Francev, we need an introduction to existentialism text. All you got to do is pick the authors, but don't get weird on us and we'll give you the money. Kierkegaard's there, right? And Camus there.
Yeah.
They're there. You know, in the Solomon edition, it's there. And Gordon Marino's edition of existentialism, it's there. You take Walter Kaufman. You take these people that, for better or for worse, have formed the tradition, and Kierkegaard and Camus are there. So there's an affinity with those thinkers. So he's going to put Kierkegaard in there. The second question I would ask him is, why the deep and consistent engagement with theological terms and concepts? The language that he uses is just loaded with theological language.
Right.
You know, the title of the third book is The Fall. Plague is one of the pestilences, seven, you know, pestilences from God that's brought down. Christ-like figure in The Stranger. So you look at the three main pieces and you have really deep theological commitments. And the altarpiece at Ghent, like you just talked about, I get it now. I really didn't know the fabulous history behind that missing piece until you introduced me to that artwork, and then I read that text that you recommended about it. But why use it? Why Judge Penitent? Why John the Baptist in there? Why the reversal of the Christ, where Marcel goes to die for nobody, not even himself, and Christ goes to die for all? Why the heavy reversal there? And one of the things I've been doing over my time with COVID here is I've been, you know, sort of really reading The Plague over and over again. And I think I'll do this with a digital edge because it'll help. Panelot is a huge part of the text in The Plague. He occupies massive amounts of territory inside The Plague. So the priest is every bit as central as the medical doctor in The Plague. So why the deep engagement with those terms? How I think he would answer that, I don't know. He might be as simple as saying, I needed to engage with my culture. And my culture is French Catholics. And the language of the Western tradition that he would have been engaging with in the 40s and 50s when these books were written, late 30s, primarily 40s, when these books were written. You understand this from teaching and having the educational background that you do. There's this cultural literacy that students are introduced to when they go to a college with a Western Civilization program or something like that, and it repeats itself over time. So you get a cultural literacy that's built up there. He may have been deeply involved in that. I think, I don't know.
Right.
I'm anxious to hear your answer to that. And number third would be, what are you going to write next? But particularly, what genre? Where was the next work? Was it a play? Was it a political tract? Was it fiction?
Right.
Was it another shot at semi-formal philosophy? Maybe it didn't turn out so good the first time. You had a little more experience. You do it the third, a little more weight behind you. You do it the next time around. So what genre, I think, was he going to pursue next? And I think he was, I would guess that he was going to go back to the theater.
Yeah.
I think that he had that period of inactivity, and I think the theater always reset him. He could write a play and get reset, and then usually the theme of the play would find itself into a larger piece of fiction or something like that.
So, right.
Yeah.
I mean, those are fantastic. And just to kind of touch upon questions two and three, mm-hmm. in reverse order, I think one of the things personally, I think what reset him about the theater was the interaction with the cast.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he was social. You know, I always tell my students that, you know, compared to Francine, he was a social butterfly.
Yeah.
He was outgoing, right? You know, he was the one who noticed her at the party, you know, and she was just kind of off to the side in the shadows drinking her glass of wine, and he went up to her. So he was really the outgoing one in that relationship. But yet when you compare his relationship to Francine, to Simone, Simone made him look like the wallflower.
Yes.
Yeah. Theater is what reset him, because as a writer, as a director, as someone who could, well, he couldn't act, but who enjoyed writing and directing and producing, mm-hmm. he got that engagement. He was, in a way, I'm not saying he did this, but in a way, as a playwright, as playwrights do, they control the marionette strings.
Yeah, they do.
Whereas when you're writing a short story, mm-hmm. you're writing any of the Exile in the Kingdom stories, you're writing any of the novels, you're right, or for that matter, any of the short fiction pre-Stranger,
mm-hmm.
you're writing for yourself, essentially. There's a cathartic moment. So I think, you know, into question three, I think writing a play would be the safe bet. I think he jumps into the love cycle of the absurd. Mm-hmm. I would say that he finishes writing, or he starts to write The Myth of Nemesis as his philosophical essay. I would be open to debate as to whether does he start with that or does he start with the play. Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah.
To answer the follow-up question that you had with question two,
mm-hmm.
I've always taught this, and I mean, you know, you and I have talked about this at fairly good length. I think the question with the elements of bringing religion into his work, I think it's, and I tell this to my students, and you and I've talked about this, I think it has to do with the fact that his maternal grandmother was such a devout Catholic,
mm-hmm.
that she really, you know, for better or for worse, beat her Catholicism into Camus and his brother. And that was something that he wasn't going to escape.
Mm-hmm.
He can, and I tell my students, you know, he can tell us that when he's in that hospital for 2 weeks, no radio, no TV, basically staring up at the ceiling,
mm-hmm.
and he lets his mind wander for 2 weeks. Yeah, he can be that angst-ridden teenager who gives the proverbial middle finger to God and says, I'm done. Mm-hmm. You know, Catholicism hasn't done anything for me. But as you know, that doesn't mean, just because he becomes an atheist at the seemingly drop of a hat, doesn't mean he's going to forget about everything that he was taught.
yeah.
in the school or yeah. in confirmation classes or, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. his first communion classes. I mean, that's embedded in him.
He can't
escape
yeah. that. Yeah, it's deep. Yeah,
it is deep. Deep. Yeah. Yeah. Now, does he use it as a, does he write about all of those, all of the religious elements in his work as a cathartic coming to peace, as a catharsis of coming to peace with his past? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Or does he just use it as great subject material?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. I'm inclined to think the latter, but right. yep, it could be cathartic for him too. Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe there is, maybe it's primarily great source material.
Yeah.
The added bonus, the cherry on top of the sundae
yeah.
is the cathartic element to
cathartic it. Cathartic in the end. Yep. Yeah. 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 Good point.
Well, thank you. Well, I think that's going to end it now. I'm going to stop the video or stop the recording. Eric, as always, it is an absolute pleasure. And for those of you out in podcast land, I hope you have enjoyed this interview of 20 Questions on Camus with Dr. Eric Berg. Until next time, take care.
Thank you.
We have a very exciting announcement. All episodes of Albert Camus Radio will now be sponsored by Vectus Consulting. Vectus Consulting specializes in consulting humanities departments, so they're a very good fit for Albert Camus Radio. Vectus Consulting specializes in growing humanities departments, retaining current students enrolled in your humanities department, and raising the visibility of your humanities department. We are very happy to have Vectus Consulting as a supporter. They can be found at vectusconsulting.org. Vectusconsulting.org.